Well, I have been giving a offering a series of talks on these short sentences. Which began as a series of three, sort of some of the few things you really need to be able to say in life. Thank you, I'm sorry, and I love you. And as I considered the things that really needed to be said in life, I added, I don't know, and I forgive you, and can I help? And today, this list is growing. I might wind up with the whole English language by the time I finish. But today, the sentences are yes, no, maybe. And those are complete sentences. Yes, period. No, period. Maybe. They don't need to be followed by anything else. And much like all of the other short sentences, like, for example, thank you, they're really only words. What matters is what's underneath those words, the state of mind, the state of heart. So you can say thank you, but you can simply say it as a formality and not really being feeling any gratitude, but just being politically correct. And similarly, you can say yes and really mean no. And you can say no, no, but really mean yes. And you can say, use the word maybe, but it might just be a cover for a decision that you've actually made and are not really, have not really suspended judgment. So the words themselves are not what is significant, but the state of being from which those words arise. Nonetheless, yes has a vibration to it. Yes. And no has a vibration, and so does maybe. And I was considering yes and no as kind of fundamental ways of looking at the world. And you know some people who are, what is it? Yes, yes people, yes, the yes man. And some people who are fundamentally no people. And as an illustration of yes, I remembered James Joyce's Ulysses and the last paragraph. It might be a little indelicate for a Zendo, but here goes. I guess I've been known to be a little indelicate, right? We had a yes dance the other night. Yes. We were yesing in the Zendo the other night. We were, some of us were dancing with the lights out and brought a lot of yes energy into Jikuchi. So this is Molly speaking. I was a flower of the mountain, yes, when I put the rose in my hair, like the Andalusian girls used to. Or shall I wear a red, yes, and how he kissed me under the Moorish wall. And I thought, well, as well him as another, and then I asked him with my eyes to ask again, yes, and then he asked me, would I, yes, to say yes, my mountain flower. And first I put my arms around him, yes, and drew him down to me so he would feel my breasts, all perfume, yes, and his heart was going like mad, and yes, I said, yes, I will, yes. Oh. Yes. I think Joyce regarded yes as the ultimate feminine word because it eliminated all resistance. It was vulnerability personified. Yes. We chanted the Kanzeon today, and I don't know how many of you have had any experience in the Rinzai tradition, but very commonly when we chant the Kanzeon, we go faster and faster and faster in Rinzai. Are you aware of this? And at the very end, Fu Ri Xin, we chant Mu. Have you done that?
My kindergarten was attached to Rinzai Temple, so.
Okay. Well, we've tried it here at Chikoji, and Mu, of course, means no, nothing. It's one of the core koans in Zen practice. But when we chant Mu at the end of the Kanzeon, and we've built up all of this energy in going faster and faster and faster with each chant, with each repetition, we chant Mu three times, more and more loudly each time, so that, I'll give you an example. You don't have to chant with me. Okay. So you would chant Fu Ri Xin, and then Mu! Mu! I'll leave it to you to hear the last one. It's just the Zendo lifts up off the ground. It's kind of the encouragement of what we call bodhicitta, spiritual energy. No! And it helps, much like a cup of tea, matcha. It keeps you going. It keeps you sitting with great intensity. And Mu is no. No. This is sort of the opposite of Joyce's. Yes. It's no. Absolute nothing. Clearing it all out. Clearing everything away. Complete and utter negation to reach this state of emptiness. Those are extremes. Most of our lives, as we go through our day, our decisions and our actions are composed of little yeses and little nos, and a kind of permutations and combinations of yes and no. In fact, probably everything we do is a combination of yes and no in various sorts. Is it true that computers operate on this binary 0 and 1? 0 and 1. Because I know nothing about computers, but I understand that that this is basically a 0-1 game. And so sort of like, and everything comes out of that. I mean, all this amazing stuff comes out of 0 and 1. No and yes, or yes and no. No. Very fundamental. I was noticing how, as I was thinking about this talk today, how people express their yeses and nos, and how you can feel that some people have a general kind of resistance to things. That they approach the world with this aversion, sort of, no. And they have to be convinced to say yes. They have to be seduced almost into yes. My mother was like this. She was a no kind of a person. And any gift she was ever given was always not quite right. It always wound up being returned for something a little bit different. A friend of mine happened to notice one day my mother and me in the supermarket, and was at a distance from us. And my mother was in her early 90s at the time, but she only perfected her. You know, it didn't weaken any necessarily as she aged. She sort of perfected her no saying. But my friend was very interested to watch how everything I brought over to my mother as a possible purchase, my mother would be shaking her head like this. And that's, I mean, all my friend noticed was my mother constantly going like that. And so, there's a certain charm to that if you're not her daughter, but but it got wearing after a while. But there are people who have this prevalent kind of, you could say, critical attitude toward the world, a no judgment about things mostly. And then, of course, there are others who are with this vibration of yes, I know a couple of these people who, as soon as they enter the room, everything is bright and joyful, and you just feel, you know what I'm talking about? That, you know, there's just, it's seeing the world, as we say, through rose-colored glasses. And when they're in your presence, it just feels very bubbling and very alive and, but there are some people who also take this to an extreme, and they can become quite annoying. There's a book written recently by a woman named Barbara Ehrenreich, and it's entitled Bright-Sided. And I have another friend who often says to me, Mado, I can't afford the luxury of a negative thought. It's kind of, and she actually lives that way. Everything is beautiful. Everything is wonderful. Everything is good. And it's only our thinking that, you know, we're thinking negative thoughts. So the person who can never see anything that is wrong or needs to be fixed, or needs change, for whom the world is always just bright and sunny, that can get also a little difficult to deal with. These general attitudes, this way of being in the world, the yes way, the no way, sometimes we call that optimism, pessimism, the optimists and pessimists. And these attitudes can be really tenacious. To try to get a no person to see the bright side of things, or to get a person who sees everything as rosy and glowing to see some of the suffering in the world or some of the negative things that are going on in the world, sometimes called gloom and doom. These attitudes can really be become what we call in our practice fixed ideas that you can't budge. There's a story about an optimist and a pessimist riding in a train, and they meet each other in the dining car, and they're having lunch, and they're exchanging their views of the world, and of course they're at opposite ends, and the pessimist is trying to convince the optimist that the world is going to hell in a handbasket, and the optimist is saying, well, it's just your thinking, everything is wonderful, you know, the world is bright and shining. And someone who is overhearing them is saying, well, let's have a little experiment here. Let's take this piece of bread and we'll put some butter on it, and we'll throw it up in the air. And if it lands butter side up, the optimist wins. If it lands butter side down, the pessimist wins. Okay, sure, we'll do that. Throw the bread up in the air, and sure enough, it lands butter side up. And the optimist says, see that? Isn't that magnificent? Isn't that wonderful? And the pessimist says, sure, you buttered the wrong side. You see how that can, those fixed views, those fixed approaches to the world can really take hold and not let go. And then there's maybe. Which may be that place which we occupy when we're sitting, and which we may take into the world with us, which is neither yes nor no, neither yes and no, but a place beyond yes and no, in the middle of yes and no, underneath yes and no, wherever you'd like to place it, but not yes or no. And some, I guess if you thought about computers, the zero and one, those aren't the only two options, right? The third option is to turn the computer off. And then you have neither zero nor one, which I like to turn the computer time. So you have a place which is outside of yes and no, zero and one. There was a farmer, another popular Zen story, who was given the gift of a herd of wild horses. Yeah, sure, you know this story. And his neighbor comes and visits and says, "Wow, what a great thing. How lucky. I got this herd of beautiful wild horses." And the farmer says, "Maybe." And in a few days, the wild horses, being wild, happens to run into his son and knocks him over and breaks his leg. And the neighbor comes over and says, "Oh my goodness, how terrible. These horses injured your son. I feel so awful for you. What a terrible tragedy." And the farmer says, "Maybe." And it turns out that because his son had a broken leg, he wasn't drafted into the army. And the neighbor comes over and says, "Why, what a great thing. Your son gets to stay out of the army. Wonderful." And so you get the idea. And the farmer says, "Maybe." A similar story. Hakuin it lives in a village in which a young girl becomes pregnant, and so young that the father refuses to admit that he's the father, and they accuse Hakuin, old Zen master, of fathering the child. You know this one. So he's brought the child, and this is, you know, "This is your responsibility, Hakuin. This is your child." And Hakuin takes the child and says, "Is that so?" Raises the child. Child turns out, you know, comes into adolescence. And the couple, of course, now is older, and they want their child back. And so they admit that, okay, these are the true parents, and now we go to Hakuin, and after all these years that Hakuin has raised the child, and they say, "This is okay, we apologize, this is our child, we want this child back." And Hakuin hands the child back. "Is that so?" So this is the maybe track. We could say it's the track of withholding judgment. Yes, no, and all the permutations and variations on that. And sometimes in our practice we speak of non-judgmental awareness. Krishnamurti often talked about choiceless awareness. Choiceless awareness. So that we are in this maybe place of, could say, equanimity. Just maybe, maybe. And knowing that we are constantly having to make decisions of yes and no, when we go to a restaurant and we choose something and we don't choose everything else. It's this, and every time we make a movement, we don't do something else. So we're in a constant flow of yes and no. But our mind state, our heart state, can be one of maybe, always that kind of tentativeness to attachment to one state or another. And so this is a deep practice to train the mind and heart to lift out of this grasping of yes and no, and the tenacious hold that often this attitude can have on us, and come into that state of suspension. Of course, we don't want to lose. Yes! And we don't want to lose moo! But we don't have to. Because from this state of maybe, we can have the deepest, most appropriate response of yes! And moo! So in our practice, we embrace it all. Embrace it all. And not to forget this, what seems to be a kind of little weak thing relative to yes and no. But it's actually very, very profound to be in this non-judgmental, non-attached, watching, witnessing, and waiting. So I invite your observations, thoughts.
I would like to just start off and say, in defense of the no people, of which I am one, an English guy did an experiment, actually a controlled experiment, with dropping a piece of buttered toast. And the results were that it does fall butter side down more often than butter side up.
Who sponsored this research?
He had some conjectures.
That's in society.
He had some conjectures to why that was true, but the fact was it did fall butter side down. I will my almost reflexive reaction in pretty much any situation is no. That's just my personality. I have learned over my lifetime that I can take a pause after that and frequently say yes. And I was also struck, by this yes, no, and maybe, how it corresponds to some key elements in Buddhist, at least what I read in Buddhist thought and in theory, as far as the greed, hatred, and delusion, and also the personality types, aversive personality types. I don't know if they're called the ones that are attracted to things. And then the third maybe is the one that's sort of spacey, not really here completely. I saw a movie many years ago called The Yes Man with Jim Carrey. And the premise of that movie is that, he's sort of suffering and his marriage is broken up and he's just like, no. Like, whatever happens is no. And he goes to some seminar and he's somehow convinced to make a vow to say yes in any situation. And that's a pretty amazing thing to think about. And of course, his yeses don't always lead to success, or sometimes they lead to some kind of messed up things, but generally his whole life has changed and he has romance and all kinds of wonderful things happen after he goes through all this suffering. But he's consistent in saying his yeses, and the thing that strikes me about saying yes in that kind of a situation is yes without any expectations. He has no idea where his yes is going to lead him. He just says yes. And I think that is really the key, for me, a key element in in that decision making is to say yes without an expectation. It's so hard to do that.
Thank you.
But yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
I'll just corroborate what Chris said. There have been many experiments, controlled experiments, on depressive versus optimistic people, and asking them for responses, and they confirm that the depressives are accurate. Are they optimistic or optimistic? It's literally true.
You mean they correlate? Depressives or those that are negative, it's more realistic?
Yes. Uh-huh. According to our measures.
Well, that's the key. There's the little key there. Yeah. According to our measures. And that's that. When I asked about who's sponsoring the research,
yeah.
I mean,
Coben used to say yes, almost always.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking that we were discussing about a week ago about a movie with Mike, a Chilean movie that is called No, very recent. And so it's about a plebiscite that occurred in Chile after 17 years of dictatorship, where people finally say no to the dictatorship. So I want to also rescue the very positive aspect of saying no.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe making a distinction between judgment and discernment.
Mm-hmm.
And good discernment is key to practice from my point of view. And discerning means saying no precisely to certain things and yes to other things. And I see that sometimes a yes can be more no than a no. And no can be more yes than a yes.
Mm-hmm.
And each time that I say yes to something, I'm saying no to many other things that I won't be able to say yes to because I say yes to this one. And when I say no to this thing, that opens many other yes to other possibilities. So like many other Dharma discussions, I think it's very important to distinguish between the relative and the absolute. And in relative reality, where we try to live an ethical life and we try to cultivate compassion in our daily activities, we need to be very precise in saying yes and no. And I wouldn't put a maybe above both of them. But when we're sitting and we're connecting with the empty nature of experience, I think maybe that is really beyond the grasping of yes and no is very, very useful.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. There are thousands of yeses and nos that have just passed through me in the time we've been talking about this. And it's, once you've said no, do you say no again, or is it a whole new circumstance? That then, it's like, okay, now I'm here. Now, what do I say? So it doesn't ever stop.
Mm-hmm. It's constant, yeah. And there is inertia that I think you've pointed to, but when you start thinking of yourself as a no person, there's an inertia when you say no. You're more inclined, maybe there's a study on this, you're more inclined to say no again, because you're watering those seeds, the no seeds, and so you're already putting yourself in that position, and perhaps there is an inertia that happens, and then it takes a much greater force to shift you around to saying yes And so, Chris, you pointed out this awareness that can come in after you said that no, or maybe said that no 20 times, and you are in that nay-saying way of being. Our practice, is that's where the maybe enters the picture, I think. If you are practicing that awareness that lifts you out of that inertial habit energy, and you can dwell in that awareness, even for a split second, you can reverse that inertia force and come into yes immediately, just as Joyce does at the very end. So our practice, really, this is a whole other Dharma discussion about the relative and many Dharma discussions. But I'm inclined to not establish that duality and to try to speak out of the unity of relative and absolute, so that it's not about, we're living in this world and we have to do these relative things, but when we're sitting, we can be here. We can be in another dimension. The question today is what would our everyday lives be like if we could carry that maybe, that place of equanimity with us in the Chinese restaurant where we have to choose, or in a politically unstable situation, that what we experience on the cushion is there. It's not in the zendo. It functions there in the relative world. Otherwise, we better lock the doors and make this our life in here. It'd be very impoverished, I'm afraid. So, I know, speaking for myself, I'm not practicing in order to keep these two worlds separate. Yes.
There's a psychologist, his name is Martin Seligman. He's devoted most of his professional life studying pessimism and what defines an optimist. And he came to be, doing his research, he said that pessimism is defined by three things. Pessimists will view an event as personal, as permanent, and pervasive. So that, let's say a student gets a failing grade or gets a paper back. Let's take something more, a paper that's a C-. Having worked very, very hard on this, they will become, I'll never get to that master's degree. I'm just useless. I'm stupid. And this event that's a no, which will shut down the yes that, maybe I didn't take into consideration that I'm working 40 hours a week, that I'm married and I have a child, that I'm tired, and this is about all I can do right now. Instead, it becomes that practice, because that's practice, eventually takes someone to a life of just, what the hell. But an optimist, on the other hand, is not necessarily defined as someone who's unrealistic. Is that their actions in life are defined first by a kind of contentment, which then leads to success. Success is a product of their they're inhabiting a world not of unrealistic expectations, but that they're fine.
Did the
Did he say that the optimist was the opposite, had of those three that you gave, is the opposite? Like, he sees the world as, or he or she sees the world as impersonal, impermanent, and unpervasive, or just of this time, or just of this
time. Limited.
Did he go on with that?
Not necessarily in a polarity like that, no.
Interesting.
Can I say something? I really appreciated the first part of course, what you said was these words are kind of empty. Because I come back a lot to, I can't keep thinking about it at the end of the talk about my nail gun, because I'm a carpenter, I've been a carpenter for a while, and I just remember, it reminds me a lot when I, especially now, like dancing, where we're talking about it kind of like dualities, yes or no, maybe, and there's a spontaneity that happens. And I found that in the beginning when I started to hit nails, just this exhilarating feeling of hitting that nail. And I was just kind of hooked onto it. But then, of course, the nail went in the wrong way, went in the wrong place, and it was just hellish to be able to pull a 20-penny nail out of galvanized. It was just, but then when it came out, it was like this incredibly beautiful event that happened. And now with the nail gun, which is taking the place of the hammer, there is yes and no and maybe going on all the time. Mm-hmm. And as I learn, first time maybe I'm shooting the nail gun, I'm shooting the header and the trimmer and the king, getting ready to put it up, and it's upside down. I gotta take the saws all, take it all apart. That didn't happen again. Because it was painful. That, oh no. But then, as it went on, it was like, all of a sudden, I'm in this dance. Yes, yes, no, no, maybe, yeah, maybe. Slow down. Yes, 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 yes. And all nail. And this is an incredibly exhilarating feeling of a rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem with the words is we need to break them up and put them into this thing here and this thing here, which is kind of, it points to it maybe, and maybe like a topographical map, as I said, but it's something else.
Yeah, well, the words have to fall away. I mean, as soon as I took hold of this stick, I knew it was over. I wish I had a nail gun, in other words. We could all nail things together. And that's why we like to do Samu together and just dance, right? Because we don't have to have words. You're talking about a kind of ecstasy. That's how I felt when you were describing your experience with the nail gun. not my thing, right. But it's your thing, and you know we have our. But I think we all sense of what this experience is, and the yes and no and maybe is a vehicle, like Buddha talked about the raft. You know, we set the words down, but they provide this. You know, we can get together and get a feeling for what it is.
It sounded like you had an event happen not too long ago where you're in the dark dancing.
It was an incredible party that happened
party.
Friday evening. And they had this, it was like, what was going on? I just
How do
snuck
you know?
In.
You weren't there.
I know,
he was
but
there.
I,
he peeked in.
I peeked
oh,
in,
did.
And it was like this event was happening that was unbelievable. It was absolutely unbelievable. And it was to walk into that would have been wrong for me. I had other things to do, but to witness what was going on is like, yes!
Oh, I was afraid you were going to say no.
It's like was... this place is, it happens here.
Yes.
And it
yes.
was the biggest heartwarming thing for me. So thank you.
Cool.
And now maybe lunch will be as ecstatic.
Let's say yes to lunch.
Yes, say lunch. Oh, so someone, yes, please, one more.
Well, I just wanted to make a brief defense of the pessimistic worldview.
Well, do we have to end on this? Okay.
Well, yes.
We don't have
to
go.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Yes, come on. I think one of the reasons that I am so fond of Buddhism is I take the teaching to be essentially pessimistic. And the Buddha, the historical Buddha, lived in a palace surrounded by servants and wealth and good food and the American dream, basically. He lived the American dream at the time. And
the shackles
sort of wore out. He sort of wore out for him. I think it's wearing out for a lot of people, actually. But he left his wife and his child in the middle of the night, as I understand it. He snuck away, as I understand it, deserted them, essentially. And then he went out, and he discovered over the years of struggle and hardship that all life is suffering, and that's the first noble truth. And then he also discovered samsara, and samsara refers to, as far as I understand, human life in this world, and this is a place of suffering, period. There is one small possibility, according to Buddhism, as I understand it, and that it is also a place for liberation, the possibility of liberation. The reality is that if we understand liberation to mean full enlightenment, none of us have a chance. Because full enlightenment, and I mean full enlightenment as it's understood in the Buddhist teachings, not as it's tossed around these days. But full enlightenment, probably in the history of Buddhism, in the over 2,000-year history of Buddhism, you know, a dozen guys maybe made it, you know, other than the Buddha. So there's a lot to be said for the pessimistic point of view.
You're a brilliant spokesman.